We never really understood what was the story behind the indigenous mob here. Yeah, what percentage is the indigenous mob in Australia?
We make up 3.3% of Australia's population in total. So out of 27 million people, we make up 3.3%. I'm not even sure if that's a million, especially indigenous youth. There are troubles there and we might be up to no good every now and again, but that's because, you know, our youth are bored. They have nothing to do. So, yeah. You know, especially in those rural communities, they're not going to school. They have nothing to work towards.
There's no purpose.
There's no purpose. And I always say this, Joel, I always say that if I had nothing in this world, except I had my culture, I knew everything would be okay. A lot of people think that, yeah, culture is your heritage and your people, your ancestors, the country you're from. Mm-hmm. And I agree, it is. And there is so much power behind it, but it's also the way you act. It's the way that you hold yourself, hold your people, and your heritage. I was heading out to an indigenous camp, and my mom asked me, she goes, if you stayed on the path you stayed on, where do you think you'd be in 5 years?
Yeah.
And I told her I'd either be in...
Joel Benicia here, right here on the Discover You podcast. We are about to go on another episode roll. This week, we've got a very important and influential young individual who's doing wonderful things in the community. Without any further ado, let me introduce you guys to Kane. Kane, how are you, mate?
I'm good. How are you, Joel? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you feeling, man?
Excited. Very excited. Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Kane, for the people on the camera that don't know who you are and are watching the Discover You podcast for the first time with you as the guest, they're going to say, who is this young fella coming on the podcast?
Yeah.
Who is he? So if they ask you, who is Kane, what would you say?
I am a proud Mabuyog Island man with connections to the Larrakia mob of Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
So my auntie has connections to the Cummings family in Darwin especially, and then our family on Mabuyog Island. Me, if someone was to ask me, you know, who Kane Munt is, I'd say just someone who's trying to make change for my people, make change for all indigenous communities around Australia, and then even in New Zealand, Native Americans. Yeah, I'm very big on indigenous advocacy.
Yeah, wow, beautiful. And how old are you, Kane?
I'm 17.
Wow, so you're doing all this at the age of 17. We originally met from the Young Achievers Award. What award did you win?
I won the Kenley Constructions. The Kenley Constructions Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Achievement Award.
Yeah.
But also finalised in the QFCC Contribution to Community First Nations Award.
Cool. And that award was given to you for what exactly?
So I do a lot of work in communities.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful. My mom and I had a lot of people nominating me for those awards.
Yeah.
So I do like to give back to community. I do a lot of advocacy. I do a lot of youth work. I do a lot of work in my college, so we're actually coming up to culture night at school next week, and yeah. We're very keen. But yeah, I'd say that I'm just very, you know, very involved with all the cultural groups at school, cultural groups in community, stuff like that.
What do you care about culture so much, man?
I think, and I always say this, Joel, I always say that if I had nothing in this world, except I had my culture, I knew everything would be okay.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Like, kids your age are focusing on video game. Obviously, you might be a gamer. Who knows? But you seem to be so attached to this word culture.
Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of people think that, yeah, culture is your heritage and your people, your ancestors, the country you're from.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree, it is. And there is so much power behind it. But it's also the way you act. It's the way that you hold yourself, hold your people, and your heritage. So I'm very attached to it because, well, at times when... You know, there's been nothing there for me. Culture has always been something that I could fall back on and, you know, it'd give me a hand up.
Yeah. And as an indigenous of this land, mm-hmm. I know that a lot of people, for example, myself as a migrant, and many of us that came in also had from different cultures around the world.
Yeah.
When we came to Australia, we never really understood what was the story behind the indigenous mob here.
Mm-hmm.
And you might need to educate me here. What percentage is the indigenous mob in Australia?
So there are three, in the Australian population, we make up 3.3% of Australia's population in total. So out of 27 million people, we make up 3.3%. I'm not even sure if that's a million.
Wow. And how did we get there?
Well, that's a...
That's a big question.
Yeah, that's a big question. Well, you know, I think for indigenous people, we are recognized in this country and we are recognized as the original stewards.
Yeah.
So not original owners, but original stewards. So we are the original caretakers and, you know, supporters of this country. And I think to be where we are at 3.3% of the population, it's not necessarily, like, it's not a bad thing, but it's also like, it's bad when we're not represented as much as we should be, you know, being the original stewards. I think it's fine if we're a small number, but people say there's strength in numbers, but I say there's strength in spirit, so.
Oof. Yeah. What a wise young man. I want to take the perspective, and because a lot of people don't understand what happened with the stolen generation mm-hmm. and the effect it's got on the youth. Mm-hmm. But we do see a lot of effects with how the young indigenous mob, for example, are incarcerated, or everything that's happening with a young mob, that many people don't even understand what's happening. And I guess without going back and forth, I want to understand your perspective as a young indigenous Australian
mm-hmm.
living in this world, living in this country. How do you see the world?
I see the world as dangerous. I'm going to be honest, it's a bit dangerous for us. I know you spoke about incarceration just before, and you know, Indigenous youth, I'll give you a fun fact. Indigenous youth, not so much fun, but Indigenous youth actually make up, I believe it is 56 to 60% of the juvenile detention centres here in Australia.
Yeah, wow.
And we are 21 times more likely to be incarcerated than a non-Indigenous person.
Like, make it make sense. How can you be only 3% of the population and yet you're sitting on 66%?
Yeah.
That's super high.
Yeah, so essentially, there's a term that's always thrown around. It's intergenerational trauma.
Yeah.
Now, intergenerational trauma is essentially spanning from what would have been the stolen generations.
Yeah.
Coming from that, you know, we got paid with alcohol, we got paid with drugs, and that has followed. People say that the stolen generations has been so long ago. My auntie was stolen generations.
Yeah, you know,
that's one generation. And people can say, hey, it's almost been 300 years, guys, get over it. Well, we see the effects through intergenerational trauma. And, you know, you see there's a cycle there that needs to be broken, but a lot of people are having trouble breaking that cycle.
And I'm guessing as a young adult growing up in this generation, do you feel a disconnect to culture?
Yeah. So growing up, actually, I didn't have much of a connection to culture. You know, I did grow up around Indigenous communities and stuff, but yeah. I didn't have that sort of connection to culture that, you know, you're always subconsciously craving. I'm not sure if you've ever had it, but there's always just this like little voice in the back of your head, and it's sort of nagging, hey, culture, you know, connection. And for me growing up, you know, I've always had a mission to embed myself more into my culture. And since Indigenous people have grown up without that because of the stolen generations and that lack of connection, you know, we were taught not to speak our language, not to practice our practices, and not to upkeep our traditions. And, you know, it's now that the blanket that was thrown over our culture is slowly being pulled back. And, you know, I'm proud to say, hey, I'm being more connected to my culture every single day.
Yep. And so as a young Indigenous fella who, of course, from a young age, you were disconnected to culture, how did you bridge that gap?
Yeah. So I always say, talk to elders. So because our elders aren't here forever, they are the ones with the most knowledge at the moment.
Yeah.
And we always say that it doesn't matter how old you are. Elders can mean, hey, you might be on the older side of the generation, so
yeah.
You know, you're considered an elder. But for us, and I got told this the other day by Uncle Eric Law, and he told me,
yeah,
he goes, an elder is not determined by their age, but by their knowledge, the way they carry our people,
mm-hmm.
and the way they uplift our people.
Yeah, wow. And so the young Indigenous, you talked earlier on, let me just go back on the facts that you brought on about young Indigenous being incarcerated and for filling up the juvenile jail, filling up the prisons. These young fellas that are getting into all sorts of trouble, do you feel like they're being misunderstood?
100%. You know, we see stories come out where Indigenous people have been just absolutely slammed because of the representation that we get. And I will admit that Indigenous people, especially Indigenous youth, there are troubles there, and we might be up to no good every now and again, but that's because, you know, our youth are bored.
Bored?
Yeah.
You reckon boredom is the reason?
Yeah, well.
Yeah, why?
If you think about it, well, it's not just boredom.
Yeah.
Like, they have nothing to do. So, you know, especially in those rural communities, they're not going to school.
Yeah.
They're not doing anything. They're not, they have nothing to work towards, really.
There's no purpose.
There's no purpose. And, you know, growing up, I would be down that same path myself if it wasn't for, well, finding a purpose. And I always say to, like, my siblings and stuff, I'm like, hey, go do a sport. Go do a co-curricular. Go do an extracurricular, you know? Anything to just keep you busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's very easy to go down that path when there's nothing there and that's all you know because that's what you were taught through the intergenerational trauma.
Yeah, yeah. Are you really going to blame the trauma for that?
I think it's not so much blaming the trauma for it. I think it's much so just showing the real reason as to why it would happen. And I think, I guess, the reason that we are up to no good or, like, some Indigenous youth are considered to be up to no good, it's not because they're bad people or it's not because they're, you know, they're doing bad things for no reason. It's because, you know, they just, and this is what they've learned. So
yeah.
our grandmothers would have been taught, hey, you don't do this. This is what's appropriate. You know, when the white people came, they would have said, hey guys, this is like, they showed us how, like how we should be treated. Essentially they beat it into us. Hey, you guys aren't meant to do this. You guys aren't meant to do that. And for so long we were controlled. And I'd say that, well, now it's just a matter of breaking that cycle where, you know, Indigenous youth are doing things that aren't too good for them. So, you know, there is a lot of alcohol, there's a lot of drug abuse, and they are up to no good. That, you know, we hear about stealing cars and stuff, and, you know, how Queensland has that high rate for it, and a lot of Indigenous youth actually make up that high rate. And I think to blame it on the trauma, it's, as time goes on, it's a bit harder to, because people would say, hey, it's been this long, it's, you know, it's gone. But that's the whole definition of intergenerational trauma, is it surpasses generations.
It's all right. It's troubling the DNA of of the people. And so, like, I'm going to play a little bit of a devil advocate, because I've had some mates where the car got stolen.
Yeah.
And what do you say to a person that his car just got stolen? He spent 50K saving for years and years and years to finally buy his ute for work.
Yeah.
And then suddenly one night it just gets stolen. And for example, when I was in Darwin, that happened, and he felt like the youth and the kids that stole it just got let off, or they got taken to juvenile and they just got taken off. And he said, the law is not fair.
Yeah, yeah. I guess from both parties, it is a bit hard to see where the justice is there. You know, so for both parties, it might be a bit unjust because, you know, on I guess that side of the party, you might hear, hey, the law is unfair because they're getting off with it, but then you're also seeing Indigenous youth making up, you know, 60% of the prisons, and it's like, well,
that's also unfair.
It's also unfair, and we're overrepresented, might I add, and
underrepresented
in the juvenile and adult detention centers, but underrepresented in this country as a whole, in general. As for your friend, I'd say, you know, while it is a bad thing that happened, and, you know, he might not feel sorry, he might not feel good about it, and it might not be a good thing for him, I'd also say, well, these youth, they have nothing else to do. You know, in the Northern Territory, it's made up, like, it is the place with the highest Indigenous population.
Yeah.
And that's not to categorize it as a bad thing, you know, that there's strong connections to culture, there's all these positive things there.
Yeah.
But like I said, that intergenerational trauma, and I understand that if that has happened, that is a bad thing, except I wouldn't go ahead and I wouldn't blame the kid.
So it's not even the kid's fault.
Well, it's not so much just the kid's fault. Like, I think the kids, they have no example to go off as to how they should be acting.
Yeah.
You know, they have no role model.
Yeah.
And I think all it takes is one person. One person, and it can change a kid's life.
Well, tell us about your story, because you were on a path from a young age, you were on a path of no good, and then suddenly you've now become this influential person, this role model for other young people to look up to.
Yeah. So I grew up in the foster system, in the out-of-home care system.
Yeah.
And essentially, you move around a lot.
Yeah.
So there'll be good places, there'll be bad places, and, you know, it never really gets old.
Yeah.
Well, it gets old very quickly,
yeah.
But it never gets old in the fact that, you know, every day is it might be a new place, yeah. A new place to, you know, call home when it's really not. And I met my foster mum in one of the short term houses I was living in.
Yeah.
And, you know, in my life changed. You know, I essentially I started living with her, and I, you know, my foster dad, he was in Perth with the RAF, so mm-hmm. the Royal Australian Air Force.
Yeah.
RAAF. And, you know, my foster mum sort of just brought me home and then sprung it on my foster dad, and like I call them mum and dad in public and stuff, yeah. Because, well, that's how I want to be seen. And,
yep.
You know, like, my dad's sort of come home and he's been like, who's this? Who is this? And I remember my mum did the same thing for the dog when she brought the dog home.
Yeah.
And, you know, she just rocked up with the dog. And, you know, I think all it took was one person. And, yeah. You know, I remember I was heading out to an Indigenous camp.
Yeah.
And my mum asked me, she goes, if you stayed on the path you stayed on, where do you think you'd be in 5 years?
Yeah.
And I told her I'd either be in juvie,
yeah.
in juvenile detention centre,
yeah.
or I'd be dead. Oof. And it was that conversation that, you know, made me realise that, hey, where I am now is a great place. Let me keep pushing. Let me push for change. And I think being able to say that I'm doing pretty well now,
yeah.
I'd say it's also thanks to my brothers. So I wanted to be a role model for my brothers, so then that way they didn't go down the same path.
Yeah, beautiful.
You know, and I'm very happy to say, and it might not all be me, mm-hmm. but I'm very happy to say, you know, my little brother, he's doing really well. Mm-hmm. He's moved to my school and he's kicking goals. So, yeah. And
all it took was
one person
to believe in
one you. Person to believe in me. Yeah.
Maybe all these Indigenous youth that are up to no good, they're only looking for one person to, yeah. believe in them.
And
it's really a cry out for love.
It really is. And it just goes to show that, you know, putting Indigenous youth in detention centres, it's not the way to go.
Yeah.
Granted, it's like, it might be a disciplinary action.
Yeah.
But if you want to see real change,
mm-hmm.
give them one person to believe in them.
Yeah.
And then watch how they change over 3 months.
Wow.
They will change.
Is there a camp? Is there a system? Is there programs that has that?
Yeah, yeah. So there are Indigenous programs, but it's not like, you know, it's not like a sort of, hey guys, you come like pick your Pokemon sort of deal. It's not sort of like that. It's sort of like both the youth and the, you know, the carers, they have to be open to it. And I think I got very lucky, and I'm very privileged. I got hit with so many opportunities at once that, you know, I said yes to all of them. I learned to say yes to all opportunities.
Yeah.
And I'm just, yeah, I got so lucky there. And I'm so lucky that, like, you know, my mum, she fought for me. And, yeah, like, if she wasn't willing to do that, I don't know where I'd be now.
There was a guest that came in on the first episode of the Discover You podcast. His name is Wayne. You met Wayne last time you were here. And he runs the Happiness Hangout. And when we had the episode with him, he spoke about that sometimes what the youth really need, they need a structure that plays game scenario. I'm not saying it word to word, but essentially what he was saying that is a lot of youth don't have a clear idea of what decisions to make in different situations. And so maybe the way forward is to have this sort of game or this sort of programs and training. Obviously the Happiness Hangout runs those programs as well, but it's the programs where the youth and the young people get to decide, hey, if I took step A, what would be the outcome of that? This or this?
Mm.
And I hear that a lot when you're talking about your story of your mum saying, hey, if you went down this path in 5 years, what would happen?
Yeah.
Now you see your life in scenarios. How many young people life would change if they could just see that picture?
A lot. There's no way to say it, but just so many lives would change because of it. You know, if every youth, every young person stopped to think, hey, what would happen if I chose this path? Or what would happen if I chose that path? Where would I be in 5 years' time? We would see change. We would see it. But
there's no one telling them. There's no one saying, hey, guys, you should probably consider, you know, another path or consider where you'd be if you did take that option. But the thing is, they don't care because that's all they know. You know, it's an impossible situation to be in, and, you know, the only way it's going to change is if we let it change.
You talked earlier on about your story and you mentioned about the foster care system. Mm-hmm. Something sprung up to my head and I said to myself, I grew up in a two-parent home and always have the comfort of my parents.
Yeah.
Like, how the heck does a child live life with not having a home? Like, what does it do to your mind not knowing that you don't really have a home? You're being bounced around like a tennis ball.
Yeah. Okay. With that, I think it's not so much that there is no home. I think that home for a lot of youth, you know, in the out of home care system, it's just a place where they feel seen, loved, and they feel safe, you know? And if you have those three things, then yeah.
Well, how do you get those three things if you're consistently moving?
See, that's a tough question. I think that is something that needs to be worked on, and I can't speak much on it because I don't know too much about that.
Yeah.
But I think from my experience, it is really difficult. And it's sort of like a gamble.
Yeah.
You know, so you move to one place and it's a short-term stay, so up to 3 months. A lot of youth say it as, after a bit of time in the system, we'll see it as, hey, this is only temporary. There's no point looking for those three factors.
Only
temporary.
And you don't even build the connection because you know I'm going to be out of here in no time.
Yeah, literally. So you think about it like this. You think about it, so the first month. So typically when it will first start, a lot of youth might think of it, hey, the first month settling in, you know, it's sort of like a honeymoon period in a relationship sort of deal. You know what I'm saying? And then the second month you might be like, okay, this place is really good. Like, I'm really enjoying it. You know, I got these three factors. I'm still analyzing. And then third month's like, oh, I'm leaving in 3 weeks. So it's pretty much like, oh, never mind then.
Yeah. And then when you have that pattern repeat again and again and
again. It's sort of like that second month where you're like, hey, I feel these. It's like, hey, there's no point.
You might get numb to the whole process if you get moved.
Essentially, yeah.
Long enough.
Yeah.
And would that be the reason some youth act out?
Possibly. So I think there are a lot of different reasons why youth act out, and I can't speak too much on it again.
Yeah.
But that's, like, I'm going to say that possibly.
Yeah.
You know, they're just looking for that role model, that person that is going to look out for them, advocate for them, and just go batting for them when no one else will.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you were in that situation, is that how you felt?
Yeah, I needed someone who believed in me. I needed someone to tell me, hey, what you're doing is not the right path for you or not the right path for anyone.
A lot of people told you, that's bad, that's good.
Yeah, but I think the way they approach it might not have been right, you know, for me at the time.
Yeah.
Because to simply say, hey, that you're not doing the right thing. I didn't care. I didn't care what was right or what was wrong. I knew what was right and what was wrong, but I didn't care. I needed someone to open up my eyes and see, hey, this is going to affect you in 5 years' time, so you might as well just take option B or take the second path, because the second path is going to, you know, while it might be a bit harder for you to, you know, get on that right track, it'll, you know, prove beneficial.
So then what's the difference between the way your mom spoke to you and then everybody else before her and the way they spoke to you? Like, how come her message touched your heart and their message didn't?
I think it wasn't just her message. It was just her actions, you know, the way that she approached everything. It was like, it wasn't scripted, you know, so like all of these systems are going to have, oh, if a young person's doing this, you got to do this. She didn't care. That's what I think, like, I loved. I was like, okay, so she really just cares about me. And it wasn't so much like about upholding policies or anything. It was much more so like, hey, This young person can do so much good, I'm going to invest.
So it wasn't because of a program, it wasn't because of funding, it wasn't because of a ticking a box, it was pure because of the heart.
Yeah. And I remember, like, she tells me all the time now, like, I might have, like, I was so close to, like, losing my job over you, because when I went home with her, and it was, like, it was all this stuff, all the legalities of it, and, like, very, very, very lucky she didn't, very grateful she didn't, and, like, I'm very grateful it worked out, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow, what a story and a half.
Mm.
And that one person was a difference and a catalyst for you transforming your life.
Yeah.
I think it's only fair to jump on and talk about some of the stuff you're doing in the community, and so that you came out from a system that was broken as a kid who didn't know where the next best step was going to be, and then one person believed in you, and now suddenly your life has changed, and now you're doing stuff with NRL.
So I do work with the NRL, so one being like social impact programs.
Yep.
But also I was the 2025 NRL Youth Indigenous Ambassador.
Yeah.
So essentially, out of all the clubs in the NRL, they each sent 4 students, so 2 males and 2 females, and they sent them all down to Newcastle. It was the Indigenous Youth Summit, the NRL Indigenous Youth Summit in Newcastle, and it was about 5 days. They actually just had their 2026 one, and it was so good to see like so many Instagram posts, so many photos and stuff, and I was like so happy to see everyone was enjoying it just as much as I did. But I just wanted to be that guy that everyone was like, oh hey Kane, how you doing? Like, I just want to be that real upbeat guy, and I was grateful and honored because I actually got given that title on the camp.
Yeah, wow.
And I remember the one thing that everyone always said, and I agree with it, I stand by it, and I told them this so many times, I was like, anyone could be up here right now saying that I get to be the 2025 NRL Indigenous Ambassador.
What do you mean by anyone could be there?
Anyone on the camp could have been. Yeah, because okay, the camp was filled with so many
talent. Yep.
Like so many great Indigenous youth.
Yeah, wow.
They're all really like just inspirational, well, you know, connected to culture, very, very like-minded.
There will be viewers watching.
Yeah.
Other Indigenous youth might be watching, and they might say, or other youth as well. So I'll give you two scenarios. First is other Indigenous youth. They're watching and they're saying, Kane, you're just lucky. You're very lucky. What would you say to them? Was it luck? How did you end up there?
Yeah. Yes, it was. I am very lucky. Because out of all the statistics in this country, I get to confidently say, hey, I'm no longer a statistic.
Woo!
But I think it was just as much luck as it was hard. And it was hard work. Now, you know, there were times where I wanted to just head back out onto the streets and just, you know, head down that old path and take up all the old bad habits, you know, that you used to have or I used to have. But it was that one person that believed in me that kept me going, my mum and my dad, but also my brothers, being that that inspiration for my brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all that hard work, you know, of just saying yes to every opportunity, loading up my plate, you know, like it works out and it pays off. And, you know, once you take one thing in, and I remember, like, a lot of people see my, like, what they call success, and I just see it as taking opportunities, but they'll say, they see what I've done, and they'll say, Kane, hey, you're busy as, like, you got a lot going on, your plate's so full, and I'm like, I wouldn't have it any other way.
Mm.
You know, a lot of people say that I need to relax, I need to, you know, wind down and just chill out, but no, I think I'm so happy trying to do a lot, because that nothing in this country for my people is going to change if I don't do a lot, because it's going to take a lot.
Oof. Yeah, nah, beautiful, well said. I guess I'm curious. Tell us a story about the first opportunity that you took. What was the first opportunity that opened everything up?
I think the first opportunity I took... That's a tricky question. That's a long time ago, I think.
Yeah? Like, where did this all start? Did you put your head in your feet and went and did something that opened up the road to NRL? How did you get there?
Just, like, I remember for the NRL camp, the Indigenous Youth Summit, I didn't want to apply to it.
How did you get involved to begin with?
Well, at school, and this is, you know, I'm very grateful to speak on this. At school, they have a program.
Yeah.
It's called the Beyond the Broncos program.
Yeah.
Now, essentially what it is, it's a branch off the Brisbane Broncos who made this program for Indigenous youth, and it's essentially assisting Indigenous youth through high school, you know, like, because there are these, there are so many Indigenous youth who don't go to school and who don't finish school.
Wow.
You know, I spoke at a at the Brisbane Catholic Education Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander graduation just last week. Oh, this week, sorry.
Yeah.
And I remember I said to my peers, I got given the opportunity to do the student reflection for Brisbane Catholic Education, and I said to the crowd of Indigenous students graduating, I said, "Yous have all just broken the chains meant to keep us down."
Oof.
You know, the same chains that were, you know, held us down 50 years ago, you know, and I think they're the same chains that make us struggle today.
Yeah.
And that's what I said, and I think a lot of us wouldn't have got to where we are without that program. But essentially through the Beyond the Broncos program, I got an email from them saying, "Hey, Kane, you should apply for this." And it was the NRL Indigenous Youth Summit.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do it at first. And then my mum, being a number one, like D1.
Wait, why didn't you want to do it?
I did start like feeling a lot of...
Were you feeling small? Were you second guessing yourself?
Feeling small, yeah. Not so much feeling small. It was more overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So just feeling really overwhelmed and stuff. And I think my mum pushing me to actually do it was a good thing, because it was the best week of my life. It was one of the best weeks I have ever had.
Wow.
You know, and it was so empowering and so inspiring. I remember I came back with like a 2 week high, because it was just amazing. And, you know, I think that's what started it all. You know, I got to go on the summit. I got recognized as an ambassador for just, you know, just trying to be a nice guy and just trying to represent our people well.
Yeah.
And that's where it started. You know, I got nominated as the ambassador, got to go to New Zealand, and actually do work with the All-Stars. Amazing as well. I went in February this year. Amazing work. And then, yeah, you know, it all just snowballed into this one, like, big, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? It's like a big, it snowballed into just a big pile of...
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah, you know, work.
Avalanche, I think it's called, yeah.
Just avalanche into
what
it is today, just a lot of good opportunities.
Cool. I'm tracking back into the first question I asked you about the Indigenous, another Indigenous youth looking at you and saying you're super lucky.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of the luck was also you taking a step forward, taking the opportunity, having your support system back you up, and you also had the mindset to get to where you are right now, because you're coming on the camera right now and you're talking with such elegance. You know what you're talking about and you believe in the things you speak about. So it's not just all luck. How can another Indigenous youth who isn't on the right path at the moment, is watching this episode and is saying, "Kane, I want to change my life as well. What can I do from where I am right now?"
Well, I'd say that a lot of Indigenous youth, I recognize that a lot of Indigenous youth are in much tougher positions than I ever have been. You know, and I think the first thing that I did is I started getting rid of all my old friends who were a bad influence. You know, so my mum, she was a good influence. So I thought, hey, I need to get rid of all the bad influence that's on me, all the pressure to do bad things. I need to get that out of my life. So then that way I can focus on doing good and following the good influence and then saying yes to every opportunity.
Hold on. Two things you just said there.
Yeah.
Getting rid of bad friend.
Yeah.
Saying yes to every opportunity.
Yeah.
The first one is hard. Let's talk about that one.
Oh, yeah. That's actually that's a hard thing to do. You know, because I was always, like, when I was younger, I was always a follower. I was always someone who was, you know, literally so easily influenced that just like that, it's like, yes, I'm following you now.
Yeah.
And I think my mum and me seeing her as, like, a much more, I guess, higher influence, a much higher influence and much more positive influence.
Mm-hmm.
I think I just knew, hey, I need to follow this influence rather than the negative one. And I think while it does suck to maybe lose friends, it's a sacrifice you have to make. Because in this life, if you want to do things and you want to, you know, get out of a tough position. You got to make sacrifices.
Yeah, but what I had someone call me up, actually reach out to me, that was part of, quote unquote, a gang, whatever you want to call it. And they were like, Joel, like, I can't let go of this group because the validation that I get, I won't get that anywhere. Mm. I feel like somebody. Is that the feeling when you're part of that negative group? You feel like people actually care about you, or do you feel like you're somebody?
Yeah, so I think back when I was, you know, hanging out with the wrong people, I always felt seen. I felt like I was special, I was someone, but I was the wrong kind of someone.
Say that again. Nah, you're a wise man. Nah, hey, Ray. Nah, that's wisdom. Say that again. I like that. That caught me off guard, man. Nah, say that again.
Say it again?
Yeah, yeah, if you remember.
I think knowing that you are someone and you are special, but you also know that you're not the right someone. That's not the someone that you're meant to be. That's not the someone that you're put on this earth to be.
Yeah.
And I think everyone knows subconsciously who they're meant to be or where they're going.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they don't see it. You know, they're in a bit of murky water at the moment. And I think it's just a matter of getting through the mud and the dirt and just putting through the hard yards to really get where you want to be.
Wow. What I picked up from that is that you can be seen by the wrong people.
Yeah.
And that could lead you in the wrong path.
100%. It's like, I want you to imagine this, Joel. Like you said, say you're hanging out with a gang or a bad influence, a group of friends, and they're not good for you, and you know that, but you're like, you're worried, hey, the validation, I'm not going to have anymore, where do I go? Or, you know, I'm not going to be anyone, I'm going to be nobody.
Yeah.
Just imagine who you are, who you're going to be, when you compare who you are after you have a good influence and after you get on the right track, versus how you would have seen yourself when you were with the negative influence.
But isn't that super hard to see?
100%. And I think you don't see it until you do it. You know, it's sort of a leap of faith.
Yep.
But if you know that that is the path you are meant to take, then, and there is someone there that believes in you to do it, then 100%.
So you really just got to take that leap of faith.
Yeah. It's all a, you know, it's a hard journey, but it is very worthwhile. And I think if everyone was like, hey, I'm going to be better, I'm going to get on the right track, you know, the world would be amazing. But the truth is that not everyone in this world is, you know, looking for that right track, because, you know, it's also about, I guess, standards and, I guess, expectations.
So, what do you mean by standard and expectations?
Well, there's standards that you hold yourself to.
Yeah.
Someone who's going down the wrong path, and I know I'd never used to hold myself to high standards or high expectations.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also the expectations that others have for you. Now, if someone has high expectations for you and they believe in you, you're going to want to hit that expectation, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Without looking at someone else's expectation for you, you're going to be stuck at the status quo. You're going to be stuck where you see your standard, which if you're hanging out with the wrong group, it's going to be their standard too.
Sometimes what I fear is that if you're so used to getting validated from a certain group of people, and that becomes your kind of reality and your identity, when you try to pull away from that, can that be lonely?
100%. 100%. And I had my best mate's 18th last night.
Yeah.
It was an amazing night. Loved every second of it. And I think for a moment throughout that journey, you know, I was finishing up with my, like, the bad influence, and I was getting off the bad path, and I was getting onto a good path, and it was year 8. And I remember I was sitting in math at school. It was one of my, like, first days back in year 8, and I was sitting in math, and, you know, we got put in a seating plan.
Mm-hmm.
And sitting next to me is Miller Edwards. Man, I didn't realize it at the time, but he was probably, he's been, like, since I've started trying to follow a good path, he has been there since day one. He's been my first, like, sitting with him in math was probably, like, the best thing that's ever happened to me. It would have been,
wow.
Like, it's probably one of the big reasons I am where I am today, because this man has been friends with me at my worst and at my best. So I think it's not so much it's lonely. It's just a matter of, you know, you might feel alone temporarily,
mm-hmm.
and you might be lonely for sure, but once you're on that good path, and you're hanging out with the right people, you're not going to feel so lonely anymore. You know, they always say that if you want to, you know, if you want to be the best, you got to play with the best.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of like that. It's like if you want to be a better person, you hang out with better people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or you be who you want to be, and you don't let anyone take that away from you.
The other side of things is, what would you say? This was actually the second question. What would you say to those who are non-Indigenous, still youth, but they're looking at you and saying, "Hey, Kane, you get a lot of special treatment."
What would I say to that?
Yeah.
I think special treatment for Indigenous people, it's overrated. Indigenous people are, you know, you'll hear Indigenous people get free housing, Indigenous people get free this, free that, you know? But you also got to understand, it's not so much, you know, a quality of outcome, it's more a quality of opportunity.
Oof.
Because if you think about it, well, Indigenous people, we're in this sort of hole at the moment,
mm-hmm.
and you know, all these extra special treatments and these extra benefits you might be getting, you know, that's just, you know, filling the gaps, evening the playing field in a way. But I don't want it to be seen as special treatment, because it's not. You know why? Because special treatment would mean that we're getting something that's above other people. But let me tell you this, Joel.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know why the government says they give us special treatment, or people say they give us special treatment?
Why?
Or do you know what it's costed? What it costs?
Why?
Just massacres of our people. Just the destruction of our land, just the stolen generations. So if you really think about it, it's not special treatment. It's just, hey, it's like a, oh, sorry package.
Damn. Like, sorry, package.
People always, like,
yeah.
And I remember people come up to me and say, "Kane, why do you get all these special benefits?"
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, "They're not special benefits. They're just, you know, it's sort of an aid." And the reason that we need an aid is because, well, we might get an aid in school because, like the Beyond the Broncos program, or like,
mm-hmm.
you know, we might get all these programs and all these opportunities, and it's because, one, for school. Let's say for school, we're in a system. We're doing a school system that wasn't meant for us. And it was only introduced 200 years ago.
Yep.
You know? And if you think about it, like, we're finishing and we're graduating in a system that wasn't designed for our people. It wasn't designed for us.
Yeah.
And I remember I asked you this the other day, but how long does evolution take, Joel?
Thousands and thousands of years, man.
Thousands and thousands of years. Thousands and thousands of years, yes. And we've already started, you know, destroying the school system. We've been smashing it. And we've only been in here for what? 200 years. So, to be able to adapt to a modern day society in Australia for Indigenous people, it'd be difficult. And it is, because, well, if you think about it, evolution, like, takes thousands and thousands of years, like you said, but we're doing it in 250.
So, really, If you're thinking in terms of a 100-meter race, everybody else starts at the 50-meter mark.
And we're at the start line.
You're starting at the start line.
They're already halfway, pretty much. So it's not special treatment.
Yeah.
It's just the principle of equity.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, you might all have, like, have you heard the baseball game theory?
No, I haven't. Please tell me.
Okay. So there's a dad and his two sons at a baseball game. Now, one of the sons is about, I'm going to say, 8, and one of the sons is about 5.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of a difference between the two sons. And the dad, now the dad's tall, he's grown up, and they each have a box to stand on and watch the baseball game over the fence.
Mm-hmm.
But the kid's looking through the fence,
mm-hmm.
the 5-year-old. The 8-year-old has a stool to stand on. You know, they each have one stool. And they're all just, like, they're watching over the fence. And that's the principle of equity. Everyone gets the same. But if we look at it Equality, sorry. That's the principle of equality. But equity, if we look at equity, equity would be everyone gets what they need. Everyone gets what they need to then make it even.
Mm.
So the baseball theory then would be, if we follow equity, would be, okay, the dad's tall enough to see over the fence without a box. The 8-year-old just needs one box to see over the fence. But the five-year-old needs two boxes to see over the fence. But yeah, man, that's like the baseball concept. And it essentially says, hey, this is equality. But also, equity would say, you know, everyone gets what they need to have an equal standing. So if we look at it as indigenous people are getting all these special treatments, it's not special treatment, it's just equity. And I wouldn't, the reason I don't call it special treatment, and I'd call it more, you know, a form of reconciliation, is because society's trying to make up for what has happened to us. You know, we were massacred. Our women were raped to breed the black out of us. You know, we were buried alive. You know, we got put on missions and camps to try and teach us a white society. You know, they hit our language out of us. It is essentially equality versus equity.
Yeah.
So equality would be there's a family, mm-hmm. A dad and two sons.
Mm-hmm.
One son's 8 and one son's 5. You know, equality would be they each get one box to stand on and watch over the fence to watch the game. But equity would say, hey, the dad's tall enough to watch the game over the fence, so he doesn't need a box. The 8-year-old, hey, might need one box to just get over the fence to see the game. But the 5-year-old would need two boxes just to watch the game. Would we call that special treatment? No. We'd call it prioritizing the people that need it most.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because as of right now, Australia is in a point in time where indigenous people are on survival. They're on survival mode. You know, we're trying to get to a point where we can celebrate and we can thrive. Not survive, but thrive. And to do that, whatever the society's calling special treatment, yeah, of course we'll take it. Because it's just another opportunity we can take to help even the playing field.
Does it even work, though?
Does it work? Not as much as it should. And I'm happy to admit that, because there are people that say would use, say, their Centrelink. They'd use Centrelink for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And that's just because, well, you know, that's what we're taught. You know, you hear stories about indigenous people going to the Bottle-O. Going to the Bottle-O as soon as they get their selling pay.
Yeah,
that
hurts me, man.
And it's because, you know why? When we lived on missions and camps and we worked hard like good little workers, the government would pay us with alcohol and tobacco. And since that's all we ever knew, it's like, hey, let's keep that going. And people say, why are indigenous people addicted to smoking and alcohol today? It's like, because that's all we've ever known. Since we have been settled.
Mm-hmm. And what impact does that do to indigenous youth growing up, knowing that that is the history of indigenous population?
I think there's not too much of an impact. Now, I'll tell you why. Because we don't learn about it enough.
Yeah,
we don't hear about it. You know, I was just at school. And the students who are in year 7, it's their first time learning about how indigenous people would see, you know, country. It's their first time learning about how indigenous people understand, connect, and feel when they're surrounded by country. And I was like, they're only learning this now? You know, if for our youth, we were learning it from the second we could crawl. The second we could talk. It's all we learnt. We learnt connection to country. We learnt all these teaching and stuff. And all these stories that are meant to get taught to us, they're not straightforwardly taught. They're not taught, hey, the indigenous people were slaughtered, the indigenous people were massacred, the indigenous women were raped to breed the black out. No one gets taught that, except that's because society refuses to acknowledge that it happened.
Is it because they refuse to acknowledge that it happened, or because the story brings in a level of shame or guilt, or...
I don't so much understand the level of shame or guilt, because now if you mean shame or guilt for non-Indigenous Australians,
mm-hmm.
I'd say no. For some it might, but I'd say no, that's not the reason. But it's just something that hasn't been added to, you know, the school curriculum.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think in 1967 we were just recognised as people.
Mm.
Before 1967 we were recognised as flora and fauna.
Yeah. When I arrived in Australia in 2008, that's when I remember on TV Kevin Rudd coming in and saying sorry.
Yeah.
Was that the
2008.
First
that was, how many years ago was that? What was 20,
uh-huh,
18 years.
Oh, I was testing your mathematics.
18 years ago. We got our first ever apology.
Was that the first ever?
That was the first ever big apology. First national apology.
Yeah, wow.
Haven't had one since. Now, I'm not saying that, surely
the goal is not for apologies to happen every year.
No, 100%.
It's for change, right?
I don't agree with that. I don't think we need apologies every year, no.
But what do we need?
We just need reconciliation. We need things to change. You know, we Indigenous people, we aren't recognised well in Parliament. We aren't recognised in the government.
What about Welcome to Country?
Welcome to Country. I'd say that's a tough topic to speak on at the moment. But Welcome to Country, it is a big part of our practices. And yeah. It's always a big thing. And I think that a lot of people, they don't like being welcome to their own country. Non-Indigenous people will say, I don't need to be welcome to my own country. I'm Australian.
Oh, that's actually...
That's what they say.
Yeah, right.
But, sure, they might be Australian. They're not Indigenous Australian. Mm. So, we're gonna welcome you to our country.
Yeah.
You know? Because the country that you know, Australia, and the states and the suburbs, you know, they aren't the country we know. You know, where we are, this is Yuggera country. But we might know it as Rocklea.
Yeah. And so,
When we welcome someone, we welcome them to Yuggera country. Well, we welcome them to whatever country you guys are gathering on.
Yeah.
And I might not welcome them to a particular country because that's not my country.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there is a much more deeper meaning behind Welcome to Country than just, hey, guys, welcome. Like, it's so much more than that.
Yeah.
It's literally a practice that we've had for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, you know, acknowledgement and welcome were invented by Ernie Dingo. You know, and I say, well, we do it in our songs, in our dances.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when you think about it, we weren't allowed to do our songs and our dances, so we verbalize it. We say it, hey, welcome to our country.
Yeah.
Because the songs and the dances that we were taught and the language we were meant to speak to do it, we weren't allowed to speak that just 200 years ago. So what do they want us to do? Just dream of our dance? Dream of our dance and then just wake up one day being like, hey, that's the dance we got to do. That's not how it works.
Yeah. Yeah, that's... Well, beautifully said. So, what I picked up from all this is that there's a huge gap in terms of education.
100%.
Because if the indigenous population is only 3%,
mm-hmm.
3 or 4%,
yeah.
Then the rest of the 97%, 95%, 94%, whatever it is, don't know enough about the indigenous culture. And I could vouch here and put my hand up and say, I wasn't even taught much, and I did my schooling here.
Yeah.
I had a lot of indigenous friends, mm-hmm. but how much was actually educated through the school system? Not much.
Yeah.
Not
much at all, and I'll tell you, I didn't go to school properly until, you know, year six. My first full actual year of school was year six.
Why do you say that?
Pardon?
Why do you say that?
That was my first actual year of school. For all the other years, you know, I was running amok. I wasn't going to school,
yeah.
And I wasn't doing, you know, what I was meant to at school.
Yeah.
I wasn't learning anything. I wasn't doing much.
Yeah.
So my first actual year where I fully did a full school year was year six.
Yeah.
And, you know, we don't actually learn about what had happened to our people.
Yeah.
We don't see it in the classrooms.
You speak so elegantly and so passionately about culture. About indigenous culture, about the youth, about the system, about change. But not all indigenous youth that I've met are so passionate about it. Some of them I personally feel like have disconnected to the culture itself.
Yeah, there's shame.
It's a shame.
There's shame, yeah. So, essentially, through the Stolen Generations, through that whole, you know, that whole period of time, the past, you know, 200 years, we weren't allowed to do our culture. We weren't allowed to practice it. We weren't allowed to speak our language. We weren't allowed to, you know, do the same dances or songs that our ancestors sung or danced. And over the years, whenever we did, we'd get punished.
Mm.
And now if that didn't generate shame, then I don't know what would.
Yeah.
Because being told, hey, you have to live like this and making us feel embarrassed by our culture, that's built this barrier. This barrier of shame.
You still believe the new age kids that are being born and that are in their teens or in school at the moment, like yourself in school, still feel that shame?
Absolutely.
How does the shame show up?
Because they're not growing up fully connected to culture. Like myself, yeah. I didn't grow up fully connected to culture.
Yeah.
And it's taken a lot to be able to, you know, at schools and at, you know, at places where I see my people dancing, I'll get up and dance.
Mm.
You know, I'll run up and dance. But a lot of youth and a lot of Indigenous youth, they won't. They won't because they're ashamed.
Ashamed of it.
You know, they think our culture is shameful because of what our ancestors and our past generations have gone through.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What our old people have gone through.
Yeah, that's a tough place to be. Mm. To be in your own country and still feel shame of your own culture.
Exactly, it makes us feel like foreigners. Foreigners on our own country.
Let's talk change, mm-hmm. because this is what's happening in the society. Are you ready now?
I'm so keen to talk about change, yeah.
All right, let's get you started then.
All right then.
I won't even ask the question. Go ahead, change. Oh, what do you reckon?
What was your question? change in this country,
mm-hmm.
it's coming. It's coming whether or not you like it.
All right, so change. How do we go about change?
I think change is something in this country that has to happen from both Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people. You know, because I do acknowledge that Indigenous people aren't being prioritized and they need to be. But I also acknowledge that there are 27 other million people that also are in this country and that also, you know, that, like, while they're in this country should be considered as well. You know, it doesn't mean that Indigenous people should be below them though. We should be put side by side and walk together as one. It's as simple as that. And I think to change that, we need reconciliation. And reconciliation is a word we hear a lot. And I think that there are a lot of ways to do or go about reconciliation. And the way you do it is, you know, it might be up to an individual or up to a state. But it doesn't need to be, you know, it doesn't need to be big. It just needs to be small. Whether it's calling out, you know, racism when it happens, when no one else will. Whether it's educating people on what Indigenous people went through or why we need reconciliation. That is enough to make change in this country.
Mm. So change is not even about the grand stuff. If each and every one of us did one thing in recognizing Indigenous people, in understanding culture, in understanding how to live together in harmony,
mm-hmm.
if each and every one of us did one thing towards that, that's enough to impact 100%. Country.
100%. It will avalanche into something much bigger and much greater than us. It will become something that, you know, unites the country.
Yeah. And that's what we need right now. Unity.
100%. Unity all the way. That's what we need.
There's a quote that I remember you saying about standing on the shoulders.
Yeah, standing on the shoulders of giants, yes.
What's that quote?
So that quote is essentially it's a famous quote for Indigenous people,
mm-hmm.
and it essentially talks about how we stand on the shoulders of giants. Indigenous people stand on the shoulders of giants.
Mm-hmm.
Now we do that as you know our ancestors are the giants, and we are standing on their shoulders, meaning mm-hmm. that what our ancestors went through, and by them doing what they had to do, we're able to stand on their shoulders and go higher than ever. That being said, you know, I want to be a, a giant they get stood on. I know that sounds silly, but you know what I mean? I want to have someone look up to me and be like, I'm going to follow in his footsteps one day. I'm going to, and not because, you know, I want to be this famous guy or I want to toot my own horn, but because it means that I've made an impact. Hopefully a positive impact, if anything. So, yeah.
Yeah, beautiful. I remember you also mentioned something about the three golden rules.
Yes. So, the three golden rules for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Mm-hmm.
Rule number one, always respect your elders. Rule number two, respect your country. And three is all about sharing and reciprocity.
So, why are these rules so important?
Well, we see these rules as the key foundations of our belief system.
Yeah.
So you know how for Islam they have the five pillars of Islam.
Yeah.
Yep. We have our three pillars of Aboriginal law.
And this is across all different country?
All different mobs. Not necessarily. It might be different, but as a whole, in today's society, we're a bit mixed together. Yeah. To be honest. And we're not as individualized as we used to be,
mm-hmm.
as our ancestors were. But, you know, I think we still have a strong connection to culture and we still try to follow these rules.
Yeah.
So we always try to respect the country. We try to respect our elders. And if you ain't respecting the elders, whew, incoming a backhand, holy.
Chaluko!
And, yeah, so, you know, you respect your elders, you respect your country, because we always said, if we look after country, country will look after us.
Yeah. I believe in that.
You know, we respect our elders because they hold the knowledge. Mm-hmm. They hold our traditions. They hold our teachings that are going to be passed on through generations to generations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They are the shoulders we're going to stand on.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have sharing and reciprocity. If you have plenty, then share. That mm-hmm. teaching is about mutual respect for each other.
Yeah. Yeah, beautiful. I love those. We're getting towards the end of our episode, and I really enjoy having a conversation with you, and I know you have so much knowledge as a young person. I don't know how you have this much knowledge, and I've asked you some tricky questions. I've played devil advocate. I've asked you scenarios. You've been able to just hammer all those questions, so kudos to you and your whole support system behind you. And it's only fair to now use you as a mentor or a role model for other mm-hmm. Indigenous youth and all youth, actually, because you're only 17, man. That is ridiculous. You're only 17 and you're this wise? What the hell? And if another young person was watching this episode and they feel trapped in their life and they say, Kane, I feel so trapped, and I look up to you and the things that you're doing and the impact you're doing in society, how can I change my life?
I'd say, after everything that's been said today, I'd say the big takeaways are say yes to every opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Reject the negative influence and take on a positive influence, whether it be a small positive influence. Any positive influence is good. And then three, have someone that you know will back you and bat for you no matter what. Someone that will believe in you. And it can be one person, because one person is all it takes.
Beautiful. Wow. And final question. Looking at your younger self, young Indigenous fella on the streets causing trouble, feeling bored, and living a life that you didn't want as a younger self.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're much older, much wiser, looking back into the young self. What advice would you give to him? What did he need to hear back then?
Oh, he didn't need to hear anything. He needed a. No, I'm kidding. I'd say, you know, if I was going to give advice to my younger self, I'd say that you have potential and you have so much opportunity to do good. It's just a matter of taking it. And I'd tell my younger self, go do it. Quit hanging out with a bunch of bums and just get it done. Because, you know, the younger me, no one was coming to save me. And I'm lucky someone did, and someone came and believed in me. But as far as my younger self could see, I didn't see anyone else coming. I saw no one in the horizon. I woke up one morning and I was blessed with an opportunity. So I took it.
Yeah, Beautiful. Discover You Podcast here. Joel Benicia here. We had Caden in the building with a lot of wise words. He saw an opportunity and he took it. When you see an opportunity, what do you do? Ask yourself that question. We're here at the Discover You Podcast. I'm joined here with Caden. That's our guest for today. He spoke some wonderful words. If you want to watch his episode, it's going to come out on YouTube at the Discover You Podcast. We also on Spotify. And you can connect to us with us also on Instagram. And thank you so much for joining us today. Caden Munt in the building. Let's go, Caden.
Thank you.